We're in the middle of trying to answer the question of whether the Soviet Union played a role in the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. So far, we've gotten context into the relationship between the Americans and Soviets, and Kennedy and Khrushchev in particular, exploring Vienna, Berlin, and the incident at Checkpoint Charlie, and the Cuban Missile Crisis. In this episode, we focus our analysis on whether Cold War spy games had any connection to the assassination of President Kennedy or to his accused assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald. What did a high-ranking KGB mole within the CIA have to do with Oswald? Was Soviet defector Yuri Nosenko, who downplayed Soviet interest in Oswald, really a bona fide defector? And after all these years, do we finally know the identity of the KGB mole?
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
I don't know what this is all about.
Dallas police this morning resumed custody. The man they have formally charged with the assassination of President Kennedy.
I'm just a part of
the man is Lee Oswald.
Was Oswald acting alone, or was he a member of a conspiracy? Commission answers, he acted alone.
I'm lurking.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. In Vienna, Austria, in 1952, Soviet military intelligence colonel Peter Popov dropped a note into an American diplomat's car offering to trade information for money. During Popov's first meeting with the Americans, he said he had been drinking too much and, quote, got rolled by a bar girl who took all of his money. Some of that money was official funds, which Popov had to replace or he would be court-martialed. After trading an organizational chart for the Soviet Armored Division for the equivalent of about $125, Colonel Popov had become a defector in place to the Central Intelligence Agency. For about 3 years, Popov provided valuable information to his CIA handler, George Kiesfalter, including technical information about Soviet guided missiles and nuclear submarines. But when Popov was recalled to Moscow, the CIA thought it was too risky to continue contact with him, and they lost their mole for a period of time, despite efforts to contact him in Moscow. In 1956, Popov was sent on duty to Schwerin, East Germany. In an overzealous effort to get back in contact with the Americans, Popov tried to give a message to the CIA through a British military officer that he saw in a restaurant in Schwerin. When one of the officers went to the restroom, Popov followed him in, gave him an envelope, and told him to give it to Kiesfalter, his handler at the Berlin CIA station. The officer Popov interacted with at the restaurant then passed the information to the CIA's British counterpart, MI6, who reviewed the envelope before passing it on to the Americans. Unbeknownst to Popov, one of the MI6 agents who became aware of his bathroom information exchange was George Blake, who would later be revealed to be a KGB mole within MI6. Blake then told the KGB that there was a GRU Soviet military intelligence mole in East Germany, but he didn't know the officer's name. In January of 1957, the chief of KGB operations against the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, Vladislav Kovshuk, visited the Soviet Embassy in Washington. During that trip, Kovshuk found out about Popov's defection in place to the CIA from the KGB's own mole who had penetrated high levels within the CIA. That's right. There was a KGB mole within the CIA, just like there was a CIA mole within the GRU. The difference was that the KGB now knew about Popov, but the CIA still did not know the identity of its mole. In November of 1958, Popov was told to return from East Germany to hand deliver a file to Moscow about an American student who Popov helped recruit to pad his recruitment numbers with the help of his CIA handlers. As soon as he arrived in Moscow, Popov was arrested. The KGB, who now had Popov under control, then used him as a triple agent against the CIA in Moscow for several months until eventually Popov was found guilty of treason and executed by a firing squad in June of 1960. The information that Popov provided to the CIA saved the US about $500 million in military research. Most importantly, in April of 1958, before he had been co-opted by the Soviets, Popov warned the CIA about an active KGB mole inside the agency who had passed on technical details to the Soviets about the CIA's secret U-2 spy plane. Popov had overheard this claim of a KGB mole in the CIA from a drunk GRU colonel. This elusive Soviet spy, for whom counterintelligence chief James Angleton was desperately hunting, came to be known as Popov's mole. As we already covered in season 2, when Oswald left the Marines in a hurry, he did so based on a lie about needing to help his mother. There were also other clues that the official story was not true, like Oswald's fellow Marine David Bucknell saying that he had personal knowledge that Oswald was selected to participate in an intelligence operation and that Oswald told him in 1959, not long before he left the Marines, that he would soon be discharged and would be on assignment in the Soviet Union. So what other evidence is there to show that Oswald, the U-2 radar operator, was a false defector? First, there's the routing of Oswald's file within the CIA. Normally, all incoming messages about a Soviet defector would go to the Soviet Russia division. But in Oswald's case, his files were sent to the Office of Security instead. According to Professor John Newman, the reason Oswald's files were handled differently is because he was being used as bait, or flypaper as Newman calls it, all in an effort to try to get Popov's mole to out himself. The idea was that Oswald would go to the Soviet Union and put on a show in the American embassy about how he had U-2 information and was willing to share it with the Soviets. The audience for this performance was the KGB, who, as the Americans were aware, had the American embassy in Moscow under surveillance. Then, when the KGB heard about Oswald's offer to provide information, they would contact their mole at the CIA to confirm whether Oswald was a bona fide defector or just an American provocation. But because Oswald's files were held in the Office of Security and not the Soviet Russia division, whenever anyone requested access to the file, the CIA would have a potential Soviet mole to investigate. However, in Oswald's case, no one ever asked any questions about him to the Office of Security, and the plan stalled out. More on why momentarily. The fact of this mole hunt using Oswald as bait can be seen in the history of how his file was handled within the agency. In order for all of Oswald's files to be routed to the Office of Security instead of the Soviet Russia division where they should have gone, someone had to set up the diverted file routing with the Office of Mail Logistics and Records Integration Division in advance. It didn't just happen, someone made it happen. And remember, Jane Roman, the senior liaison officer on the CIA's counterintelligence staff who personally handled Oswald's file, told Professor Newman and Jefferson Morley in 1994 that Oswald's file was, quote, held very closely on a need-to-know basis. There's no plausible reason to have this level of interest in Oswald and to ignore all of the normal rules of CIA file routing unless Oswald was working with or for the CIA in some capacity. The CIA has never explained why Oswald's file was routed this way. In 2012, esteemed JFK assassination researcher Malcolm Blunt met with legendary CIA counterintelligence spy Pete Bagley at Bagley's home in Brussels to ask for his opinion about documents related to Oswald's time in the Soviet Union. Looking at those documents, and in particular the routing of those documents, Bagley confidently told Blunt that Oswald, quote, had to be a witting false defector. And this is consistent with what FBI liaison to the CIA, Sam Papich, told the Church Committee. He said that he remembered there were, quote, discussions of a plan to have a CIA or FBI man defect to Moscow. On December 15, 1961, KGB Major Anatoly Golitsyn defected to the CIA from his post as a vice consul at the Soviet embassy in Helsinki, Finland. Shortly after his arrival in the United States, Golitsyn was interviewed by James Angleton, with whom he would eventually become close once he had established his bona fides and proven that he was a legitimate defector. Most importantly, Golitsyn's defection led to the discovery that the head of counter-espionage operations for Britain's MI6, Kim Philby, was himself a Soviet mole. Philby had become friends with Angleton during his OSS days in London while they were fighting World War II. Angleton was initially suspicious of Philby during the war due to a few incidents where Philby failed to provide information when he should have. Still, Philby would later gain Angleton's trust, and the two men worked together regularly. Kim Philby's placement at the top of British intelligence meant that every time the Americans shared something with the Brits, which was often, the Soviets also knew about it. Philby ultimately got away with his treason, defecting to the Soviet Union and becoming a national hero there in 1963. Aside from bringing down Kim Philby, another area where Golitsyn was helpful to the CIA was distinguishing the difference between genuine and false Soviet defectors. Golitsyn's skill set would soon be called upon when it came time to decode the riddle of Yuri Nosenko. Let's say you have travel coming up. Summer vacations or weddings abroad. Maybe an international work trip. Imagine arriving actually understanding the language, ordering food confidently in restaurants, connecting with locals, and feeling immersed instead of just visiting. Rosetta Stone has been a trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive method helps you naturally absorb your new language, no memorizing random vocabulary lists, and no relying on translations. Instead, you learn by connecting words, visuals, and meaning in context, the way language is meant to be learned. The Rosetta Stone lessons are easy to fit into your day. They don't take that long. One of my favorite features is True Accent, which helps make sure that you're pronouncing the words correctly based on where you are. For me, I know I've always wanted to go to Italy, and I know that I'll be brushing up on my Italian with Rosetta Stone when I make that trip. With 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages to choose from, including Spanish, French, German, Japanese, and more, Rosetta Stone is the go-to tool for real language growth. Learn faster and retain longer. Rosetta Stone immerses you in your new language naturally, helping you think and communicate with confidence. It's not just English translations, so you're truly learning how to speak, listen, and think in your chosen language. There's an intuitive learning process. You start with words and then you build to phrases, and eventually you progress into full sentences. So if you're ready to learn a new language this spring, visit rosettastone.com/today to explore Rosetta Stone and choose the language that's right for you. Go to rosettastone.com/today now and begin your language learning journey. Okay, so I've never been a huge weed person, but this guy that I know, let's just say, is. So whether you're like me or the guy I know, or you're really into weed, whatever it is, you're about to nerd out big because there's this company called Mood.com, that's changing the way people buy cannabis. Here's the science, and this is the part I love. The reason different cannabis strains make you feel different ways isn't just about THC, it's also based on other components called terpenes. Terpenes influence how your bud tastes and smells, but they also affect what you feel. So one terpene might make you feel uplifted and energetic, and another one makes you relaxed and sleepy. There are dozens of these. So when you have the right combination of terpenes, you can feel social, focused, creative, aroused, chilled out, or whatever. You just go to mood.com, click shop by mood, and that's it. Want to be more social at a party? There's flower for that. Need to focus and get more work done? There's flower for that. Want to melt into your couch and watch movies? Yep, flower for that too. And here's the part few people realize. It's now 100% federally legal to have really great bud shipped right to your door. It's third-party lab tested and comes in a discreet box. Best of all, everything is backed by Mood's 100-day satisfaction guarantee. And like I said, you can get 20% off with code JFK. So head to mood.com and get 20% off of your first order with code JFK. On February 4th, 1964, about 2.5 months after President Kennedy was assassinated, KGB officer Yuri Nosenko defected to the CIA in Geneva, Switzerland. Nosenko's defection was handled by none other than CIA counterintelligence officer Pete Bagley. As you can imagine, the CIA was paranoid about false defectors from the KGB who were providing false information in hopes that the Americans would rely on it. Yuri Nosenko was no exception to this paranoia. Nosenko said that there was no KGB mole in the CIA, and Golitsyn, the earlier KGB defector who was determined to be legit, said that he knew that Nosenko was lying about the absence of a Soviet mole. Starting in April of 1964, Nosenko was confined and interrogated in a safe house in Clinton, Maryland, until mid-August of 1965, when he was moved to a specially constructed jail just for him in a remote wooded area. The Soviet Russia division of the CIA was convinced that Nosenko was an agent sent from the KGB under false pretenses, but they were unable to prove it or to get Nosenko to confess. Nosenko stayed in that jail under constant interrogation until October of 1967. The reason Yuri Nosenko is relevant to the JFK assassination is that he claimed that he supervised the KGB file on Lee Harvey Oswald and that he was responsible for compromising Americans who were visiting Moscow, which, if true, would mean that Oswald was under Nosenko's jurisdiction when he visited Moscow in 1959. Nosenko said that he researched the question of whether there was ever any relationship between the KGB and Oswald after Kennedy's assassination. Nosenko claimed that while Soviet intelligence did surveil Oswald, it viewed him as mentally unfit and never debriefed him or had any relationship with him. As Gerald Posner puts it, quote, "If that was true, it meant that the KGB and the Soviet Union were absolved of complicity in JFK's murder." So, was Nosenko really a genuine defector who could be trusted about his Oswald claims? Or was he a liar who was sent by the Soviets to deceive? When Richard Helms became the director of the CIA, he was undecided about Nosenko's bona fides. He knew that the matter had to be resolved. Helms assigned the CIA's Bruce Soley to be responsible for a complete review of Nosenko. According to Posner, Soley, who trusted Nosenko, was, quote, a 16-year veteran and the agency's most experienced spy catcher. On the other hand, Angleton, the counterintelligence chief, and Pete Bagley, a KGB expert for the CIA, who was the one who processed Nosenko's defection, were both certain that Nosenko was a Soviet plant. In a comfortable Washington, D.C. safe house, Nosenko was interviewed under friendly conditions by Bruce Soley for more than a year. Aside from Soley's casual talks with Nosenko, there was other evidence to support that Nosenko was a real defector. He gave 6 solid leads about Soviet spies penetrating European allies, which resulted in some of those spies actually being arrested. Even after these arrests, Angleton and Bagley continued to doubt Nosenko, responding that Nosenko had simply given up low-level assets who were disposable. In September of 1968, after Nosenko passed a polygraph test, Bruce Soley submitted his final report concluding that Yuri Nosenko was a bona fide defector. In March of 1969, Director Helms hired Nosenko as a KGB consultant, compensated him for his imprisonment, and provided Nosenko with a new name and a clean slate. As of today, the official policy of the CIA remains that Nosenko was a genuine defector. In 1992, author Gerald Posner interviewed Nosenko, who one would think must have been hard to find with a new identity. Nosenko confirmed to Posner that the KGB had no interest in Oswald. So why exactly were Bagley and Angleton so sure that Nosenko was a false defector? First, when he defected, Nosenko was supposedly in Geneva providing security for the Soviet delegation to a conference there. He had no fixed duties or requirements for the conference. He also said that he wasn't staying with the rest of the delegation. As he was processing Nosenko, Bagley knew that it was against KGB protocol for officers to stay at a different hotel from the delegation that they were supposed to be securing. The only person who knew where Nosenko spent his time, according to him, was his friend Yuri Guk, who worked at the Soviet intelligence station in Geneva. Nosenko told Bagley that his roommate at the hotel was Alexander Kislov, who was, quote, a journalist who had nothing to do with the KGB. Neither of the two men who Nosenko mentioned to Pete Bagley during that first meeting had the jobs that Nosenko said they did. Both Yuri Guk and Alexander Kislov worked for the Deception Department of the Second Chief Directorate of the KGB. The Deception Department was responsible for launching deceptions against the CIA. Quite a coincidence when Nosenko is alleged to be deceiving the CIA in exactly that type of operation. Perhaps the most alarming fact about Nosenko came from FBI documents that Bagley reviewed about a 1957 trip to Washington by Vladislav Kovshuk, the chief of operations against the American embassy in Moscow. Kovshuk was traveling under a false name and frequently attending movie theaters throughout the Washington area. The FBI never caught Kovshuk in the act of meeting with any American officials at these theaters, but the reports captured the names of the two men who were traveling with Kovshuk, Yuri Guk and Alexander Kislov, the same two men who Nosenko mentioned to Bagley after he had a few drinks that first meeting, as having nothing important to do with Soviet intelligence, also went to America together and loitered around movie theaters, ostensibly looking to make contact with an American spy. This fact apparently did not faze the Central Intelligence Agency. The chapter of American history on Yuri Nosenko was almost closed with the conclusion that Nosenko was legit and that he must have been telling the truth, that Oswald was, quote, not considered to be an interesting target by Soviet intelligence. But a meeting in 1994 between Pete Bagley and former KGB chief Sergei Kondrashev would bring new information to light and conclusively establish that Yuri Nosenko was a false defector who had been sent to deceive the Americans by the KGB. Bagley and Kondrashev, who were fierce rivals during the Cold War, struck up a friendship after meeting at a reunion of Cold War intelligence officers from both sides. At this first meeting, Bagley asked why Vladislav Kovshuk went to Washington in 1957 with Yuri Guk and Alexander Kislov in the first place. Kondrashev responded, quote, oh, that was to meet an important agent, one who was never uncovered. During Nosenko's first meeting with Bagley, he mentioned that his boss, Vladislav Kovshuk, was sent to the United States to try to reactivate an American spy named Andrei after the KGB had lost contact. In the second meeting, however, Nosenko played down the importance of Andrei. It turned out that there was an Andrei, who was a low-level cipher machine mechanic that was recruited in Moscow when he was working for the American embassy. But visiting Andrei was just a cover. The real reason for Kovshuk's trip to the U.S., according to the former head of the KGB, was to meet with Popov's mole in the CIA, who was never discovered. And when Kovshuk, who was Nosenko's boss, came looking for Popov's mole in 1957, he did it with the help of the two men that Yuri Nosenko was hanging out with when he defected, Yuri Guk and Alexander Kislov. Regarding Nosenko, Kondrashev confirmed to Bagley that he was not genuine, saying, quote, how could your service have ever believed in that man? Nosenko had claimed that the Soviets merely surveilled Oswald, but were not actually interested in him. However, declassified documents now make it clear that Oswald was of interest to the Soviets. On November 4th, 1959, a few days after his dramatic performance at the American embassy, Oswald spoke to the KGB about, quote, the subject of possible use abroad. According to KGB Colonel Oleg Necheporenko, Oswald said during this meeting that he was willing to share secrets with the Soviets, which placed Oswald in the most serious category, espionage. In 1991, we learned during an episode of ABC News Nightline with Ted Koppel that the Soviets intercepted Oswald's first letter to the American embassy in 1960. ABC News claimed to have seen the letter in Oswald's KGB files. So we know that the KGB at least cared enough about Oswald to steal his mail. Finally, there is some evidence that Oswald was even more involved with Soviet intelligence than previously known. In 1981, KGB officer Sergei Papushin defected in place to the CIA while still working for the KGB. Papushin, who had an affinity for alcohol, was given the code name IJ Decanter, which was exposed by journalist James Risen in 1997. According to what Papushin later told the CIA, a former Colonel Yershak, who he reported to in the KGB, told him that Marina Oswald was a swallow who was directed by the local branch of the KGB in Minsk to sleep with Oswald. As far as Oswald himself, he was not a KGB agent, but the local branch in Minsk had a file on Oswald and considered him to be an agent to pad their numbers. Once he was back in the United States, Oswald never had any involvement with the KGB, and Marina refused to cooperate with the Soviets once she reached America in hopes of seeking a better life. We just talked about how Bruce Soley was centrally involved in determining whether or not Yuri Nosenko was a bona fide defector. As noted, we now have evidence that Nosenko was a Soviet provocation all along. When we zoom in on Bruce Soley, the reason for his pro-Nosenko leanings becomes clear. It was Bruce Soley's job as the chief of the Office of Security's research branch to lead the day-to-day search for Popov's mole. While Pete Bagley was never able to determine the identity of Popov's mole, Professor John Newman alleges that the mole was the man who set up the mole hunt, Bruce Soley. This would explain Soley's insistence on focusing the mole hunt on the Soviet Russia division only, and it would explain why Soley could never find the elusive mole. According to Newman, it was Soley the whole time. Newman believes that Soley was Popov's mole for a few reasons. First, we know the mole had to be very high within the CIA, and Soley fits that description. Second, KGB officer Vladislav Kovshuk went to Washington to meet with Popov's mole in January of 1957, which is where Soley lived. Third, Soley traveled to Zurich, Switzerland immediately after Kovshuk's visit to the U.S. in February of 1957. Fourth, Soley lied to both FBI liaison Sam Papish and to the CIA's Jane Roman when they asked about Oswald. For example, when Papish asked about Oswald, he was told there was, quote, no info on subject. Soley then documented, quote, oral FBI name check request in Oswald's file, which Soley had just told Papish did not exist. Finally, fifth, and most convincing for Newman, Soley traveled to Paris in May of 1962 and then again in June of 1962. The May trip is not explained. There's no claim that he was on vacation, and there's no CIA explanation for why Soley was in Paris in May. We know from French intelligence that a senior KGB officer, Mikhail Symbol, was present in Paris in May of 1962 at the same time Soley was there. If you're interested in even more arguments that Newman makes against Bruce Soley, you can read about them in his book, Uncovering Popov's Mole. Next time on Solving JFK, we wrap up our series on the Soviet Union by addressing arguments raised by former CIA director James Woolsey that Lee Harvey Oswald acted on behalf of the Soviets and killed President Kennedy without any help. If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information.